we are to live lives of humble obedience, based on the fact that that's an example from Jesus, from verses 6 through 11, and also because it's God who's working in us to will and to act. This masterpiece that God is working to create in you is being done by the Lord Himself, and for that reason, we need to do everything that we do with our hearts with fear and trembling. Because it's such an awesome thing to actually do something with that which God is working on. So that's what we found last week. Now, verse 14, he says, "Do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like stars in the universe, as you hold the word of life in order that I may boast on the day of Christ that I did not run or labor for nothing." That's one of those sentences that kind of seems to get away from him. He gets to go on one thing, then the next thing, the next. It's quite a sentence. We'll see if we can unpack it here. There's some questions that we need to ask about this. There's some kind of difficult things. Why does he say that we need to become children of God, or the Philippians need to become children of God? Become children of God. That's what the word means. It means become. Aren't they already children of God? And what does complaining have to do with what we've been talking about? Why brings up such a minor little thing when we're talking about these great grand principles? Let's take a look at this. Verse 14, do everything without complaining or arguing. Now, the everything there is what he's just been talking about, all the obedience. Live the obedient life, the humble life of humble obedience. That is, work out your salvation. That means just carry on being a Christian. Carry on being a Christian without complaining or arguing, or live the life of obedience without complaint or argument. Complaining is basically any time you express dissatisfaction with the circumstances in your life. That's complaining. The word complaining here is a funny word. It's gongousmos. It's one of those onomatopoetic words that sounds like what it is, like our word murmur or grumble. It's just one of those low-pitched kind of grumbling, murmuring, gongousmos. I don't know how it came out that way, but that's what the word is. And it has to do with grumbling. It's sort of a more of an emotional term. The next term is arguing, and that's a little bit more of an intellectual kind of a complaining. It still, in this context, means complain, but it's a more cognitive. So the idea is the first one is sort of a visceral kind of emotional rejection of the circumstances that God has given you in your life. And the second one is sort of an arguing with God. This shouldn't happen to me because of this, because of this, and why is this happening? And when you sort of debate and argue with God. So it's the emotional side and the intellectual side. He says, don't argue in either, or don't grumble or complain in either way. And the point that he's making here in context is this: if you're going to live the Christian life, realize this, the Christian life, the life of obedience is not merely external. That's just so important to understand, the Christian life. It's so basic. What God calls for is obedience of the heart. And if you do what God says to do, but you do so with a grumbling, complaining attitude, that is not obedience. And so he says here to obey without complaining. Turn to Exodus 14, because the word gongousmos is a term that's unusual. It's not common in the New Testament, but it's a very clear reference to what happened with the Israelites in the Old Testament. It's used very often in the Greek translation of the Old Testament to describe the greatest group of complainers of all time. The children of Israel in the desert were world-class complainers. And that's the word that's always used of their grumbling and complaining, is this word gongousmos. And so Paul is calling us to remember that. And so I want to just take you through a little bit of a trek along with the Israelites so you can see how this sounds. Exodus 14, we'll start at verse 10. And we actually talked about this last week, the same scene. They just escaped Egypt. They ran here into the Red Sea, and now they're stuck. Pharaoh changed his mind, decided not to let him go. Here he comes with his army. They're standing there. They don't have any weapons. They don't know how to fight. They're totally vulnerable. And here comes this army ready to slaughter them. And they're concerned about that. And so as Pharaoh approached, verse 10, the Israelites looked up, and there were Egyptians marching after them. And they were terrified and cried out to Yahweh. And they said to Moses, "Was it because there was no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done by bringing us out of Egypt? Now get this, listen, 12. Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? Their memories are already going a little bit bad here. They think they liked the serving the Egyptians. Anyway, it would have been better. They cried out to God for deliverance from serving the Egyptians. Anyway, it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die here in the desert. Automatically assume God's not going to protect them. So in chapter 15, God performs a miracle, drowns all the Egyptians in the Red Sea, and all the people are rejoicing, and they're singing, and they're dancing, and they're happy, and they say, sing to Yahweh, for he is highly exalted. The horse and the rider have been thrown into the sea. They're happy. They're praising God. 3 days later, look at verse 24. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what are we supposed to drink? They don't find anything to drink, so they're complaining again. So now God miraculously responds again, verse 27 of chapter 15, and he gives them some water. They're going through the desert, and they just happen to come across a place that has 12 springs and 70 palm trees. Interesting that they would run across a place like that in the middle of the desert. And so that's pretty neat. So now they have everything to drink. They got all these palm trees. Everything's fine. It's wonderful. God provided again with another miracle. And so how do they respond? 2 verses later. It says, in the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by Yahweh's hand in Egypt. We sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you brought us out of this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. Back there we had meat. We'd rather die if we were dying eating meat than being out here. This is horrible. We don't have any meat. Nothing is ever enough. God provides everything they need, and every time they have a problem, they complain again and they assume they're going to die. And so God sends manna, and he sends quail, and so then they're fine again, and they move on to the next place. And the next campground they find, they don't immediately find water right there at chapter 17, verse 2. And so what do? They begin to complain again to Moses. Why? And Moses says, why do you put Yahweh to the test? But the people were thirsty, and they weren't going to listen to reason. So verse 3, they're thirsty, and they grumbled against Moses, and they said, why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst? And the Israelites quarreled, and because they tested Yahweh, saying, is Yahweh among us or not? Now, skip over to Numbers, chapter 11. Numbers, chapter 11, we'll just keep going with this. As soon as they got into that desert, they started complaining, and they just never stopped. Verse 1 of Numbers 11. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of Yahweh, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused, and the fire from Yahweh burned among them and consumed some on the outskirts of the camp. I want you to get not only the fact that they continually complained, but I want you to see God's responses to this. This makes God very angry. Complaining does. So he burned some of them. Now, verse 4. Again, Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. They didn't learn their lesson even right after that. And we remember the fish that we ate in Egypt and at no cost, and the cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. Some diet they had there in Egypt. And then verse 6 says, and now we've lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. We always have this. We're sick of this. And that's the way it was, all the way from Egypt, all the way through the desert, all the way up to the promised land. And God, remember what God's doing here. He's rescuing them from slavery, bringing them into the land of milk and honey. The promised land, paradise. And in Numbers chapter 14, they get there. They arrive at paradise. They arrive at the most fertile land. They call it the Fertile Crescent over there. It's the most wonderful place in the world. And it's theirs. And it's, God promised it to them. And it's flowing with milk and honey. It's rich. It has dates and almonds. I mean, it's got all kinds of wonderful food there. And the land is plush and it's beautiful. And it's their inheritance from Yahweh. It was promised to Abraham. And they get their first glimpse of this wonderful place. And in verse 2 of Numbers 14, it says, all the Israelites grumbled. And they said, if only we had died in Egypt or in the desert. Before they said it would have been better to die in Egypt than die in the desert. Now they're saying it would have been better to die in Egypt or the desert instead of this. And they say, how can they know how to complain? They haven't even seen it yet. They just got there on the other side of the river. None of them have seen it except 12. They sent 12 spies to come across the river and check it all out. They came back. None of the Israelites have even seen the land, and they're grumbling. Why are they complaining about something they've never seen? Here's why. Those 12 guys came back, and 10 of them said, "It's a lousy place. We can never, people are too big. We're never going to be able to handle it. God's not going to give it to us. It's going to be terrible. We're all going to die." 10 guys started an entire nation complaining about something they had never even seen. Almighty God delivers them from Egypt miraculously with all the plagues and everything else. Then he miraculously leads them and provides for them and protects them in the desert. And then they get to the promised land, and God says, "This is a wonderful place." And the 10 guys say, "No, it's not, it's crummy." And all the Israelites believe the 10 guys instead of God, and they all start grumbling and complaining about something that they'd never even seen, something that was actually very wonderful. Just as an aside, complaining is contagious. It's infectious. If you ever want to get some people in the church to agree with you, just complain. If you ever want to ruin the church, just ruin it. Then start complaining and start convincing everybody that God is not really good, and you'll have a following in no time, because there's something in us that just tends to quickly follow complainers and join right in. So because of their grumbling, they don't enter the promised land. God doesn't let them in. He says, because of that, you're going to wander in the desert until you die. In verse 6, Joshua and Caleb, they're the two that gave a good report. They speak up, and they said, verse 7, they said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If Yahweh is pleased with us, He'll lead us into the land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. And only do not rebel against Yahweh, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we'll swallow them up. Their protection is gone. But Yahweh is with us. Do not be afraid of them." But, I mean, that sounds like a great speech, but you know what? One of the most dangerous things you can ever do is get in the way of complainers by saying something positive. If you say something positive in the midst of a lot of complaining, you put your life at risk, which is exactly what they did. Verse 10, the whole assembly talked about stoning. "Don't you dare show any faith or confidence in God or any optimism. We're trying to complain here." So they are going to stone him. And then verse 11, Yahweh said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me, in spite of all the miraculous signs that I have performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them." And no one, verse 23 says, "No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it." Verse 27, "How long will this wicked community grumble against me? I have heard the complaints of these grumbling Israelites. So tell them, as surely as I live, declares Yahweh, I will do to you the very things I heard you say. In this desert, your bodies will fall. Every one of you, 20 years old or more, who has counted it in the census and who has grumbled against me, not one of you will enter the land." He says, you keep saying you're going to die. You're going to die. You know, that. Be careful about pessimism. Because, you know, they kept saying, we're going to die. We're going to die in the desert. We're going to die in the desert. We're going to die in the desert. And finally, God said, fine. You're going to die in the desert, if you refuse to go into the promised land, like I said. And they do die in the desert. They didn't have to. Number 16, verse 41, the whole Israelite community grumbled. Even after that, they didn't learn their lesson. They're still grumbling. And God was furious over that. He sent a plague, killed over 14,000 of them. And you'd think they'd learned their lesson from that, but skip over to chapter 20, verse 3. They didn't learn their lesson from that. It says they quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before Yahweh. If only we had died in Egypt. If only we had died in the desert. If only we had died back then. Now, if only we had died in the plague. Why did you bring Yahweh's community to the desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs or grapevines or pomegranates, and there's no water to drink." Chapter 21, verse 3. Then Yahweh listened to Israel's plea and gave the Canaanites over. Now they have to face the Canaanites. They're not trained for battle. They don't know how to fight. And here they have to fight the Canaanites. And so they cry out to God for protection. God listens. He gives them a victory. He listened to Israel and gave the Canaanites over to them and completely destroyed the Canaanites and their towns. And so the place was named Hormah, and they traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go to around Edom, the people grew impatient on the way, and they spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food." And then Yahweh sent venomous snakes among them, and they bit the people, and many Israelites died. Start to get the picture here? There's just no end to their complaining. Nothing is ever enough. They think they want water, God gives them water. They think they want food, God gives them food. They think they want meat, God gives them meat. They think they want deliverance, God gives them deliverance. Everything they ask for, God gives them. And as he said to David, "If that would have not been enough, I would have given you more." And nothing's enough. Now, I want you to understand one thing. There would have been nothing wrong with the Israelites seeing the Egyptians coming and crying out to God and saying, "Please save us from the Egyptians." There would have been absolutely nothing wrong with Israelites saying, "Lord, there's no water to drink here. We can't find any water. Please provide us with some water." There wouldn't have been anything wrong with them saying, "God, give us..." Even if they would have said, "God, we've had this diet for a while. Would you please provide us with some variety? Maybe a pomegranate." There's nothing wrong with praying for a pomegranate if you want a pomegranate, right? The sin was the fact that instead of asking God for what they needed, they just simply assumed God would not provide for them, would not protect them, and that they would die. Every time, they immediately assumed we're going to die. And that's one thing that makes complaining such a serious sin. Those people were not destroyed. Now, when you think about complaining, please just don't think about the verbiage of it. Those people were not destroyed because some words inadvertently slipped out of their mouths. It was because of the unbelief in their hearts. In fact, turn back to Numbers 11:11. I want you to just take a look at that verse again, because it's a crucial verse for understanding why complaining is such a serious sin. And we need to really get a grip on this verse. Yahweh said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs I've performed among them?" You see, complaining at the root of it, at the heart of it, is a refusal to trust God. It's unbelief. Remember what it is. It's expressing discontent over your circumstances. Who's in charge of your circumstances? God is. And so when I complain, I'm accusing God of not doing what's best. That's what complaining is. It's accusing God of not, it's accusing Him of failing in doing what's right. If swearing is wrong because it takes God's name in vain, then complaining is wrong because it takes God's promises in vain. And it's not a sin that's just superficial. It's a symptom of a deep-seated spiritual problem, because it's a failure to trust God. It's a mark of unbelief, which is a serious sin, because if you don't believe God's promises, you're calling God a liar. And God hates that, and He's killed people for that. So at the heart of it, it's a serious sin because it's a lack of faith. And then secondly, look back at Numbers 11:11 again. Here's another reason that shows us why it's so serious. Yahweh said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me with contempt?" See, another reason why complaining is God is because it's an act of contempt. It's an act of hostility toward God. You can just hear the hostility in what the Israelites said. You know, and if you think back, all those things they said, they're just hostile. They hold God in contempt. It's never appropriate to be angry at God. It's never appropriate to even be disappointed with God. I say that because I was reading this week about disappointment with God and how the Christian counselors tell us to deal with our disappointment with God. If you just type in "disappointment with God" on the internet and do a little search, you can find all kinds of advice from Christians on how to deal with your disappointment with God. And basically what it comes out to, everything I read, said most of them say that it's okay to be disappointed with God. All of us are disappointed with God, and there's no sense in trying to hide that. God knows how you feel anyway, so why hide your feelings, your true feelings? He knows what's in your heart, so you might as well express it. In fact, you might as well just vent it, because that's really the most healthy thing to do psychologically anyway, is just vent that. So it's true that God knows how you feel. And it's true that it's useless to hide anything from God. If you've got some feeling in your heart, disappointment or whatever, there's no sense in trying to lie to God and say it's not there, or lie to yourself. If it's there, it's there. But do we need to vent it? We don't need to vent it. We need to repent of it. If there's some wrong attitude in your heart towards God, you repent of it. You don't vent it. Does God understand? Is he big enough to understand our being disappointed with him? Well, yeah, he understands it. What he understands is this. If you are disappointed with an infinitely perfect being, then there's something wrong with your expectations. There's something wrong with me if I am disappointed and unhappy with a perfect being. There's nothing wrong with him. If I'm disappointed with a God who promises to only do what's best, then the only explanation is that I don't believe the promise, right? If I'm disappointed with a God who promises to only do what's best, if I'm disappointed in him, if I'm angry with what he's doing, the only explanation is I don't believe him when he says what he's doing is best. So, when we assume that he won't do what's best, and then we voice that and complain about it, that is an act of hostility against God. And if you remind yourself back to the context of Philippians 2, what we're talking about here, humble obedience, think about that. You can see now why this verse fits in exactly with what Paul's saying. It's impossible to live a life of humble obedience, obedience with fear and trembling, and have an attitude of contempt and hostility towards God and his commands. Obviously, that's impossible. If you have an attitude of hostility towards God, that's not humble obedience. Having that kind of attitude is rebellion. You see, listen to this. Complaining is a refusal to submit to the providential plan of God for your life. By providential, I mean the circumstances that just happen to you that are outside of your control, things that God is in control of, that he allows to happen to you. He allows those things to happen to you. That's his providential plan for your life. And complaining is a rejection of that plan. It's a rejection of the lot in life that God has assigned to you. Lamentations 3:38, profound verse, it says this. Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both calamities and good things come? Why should any living man complain? What business do we have complaining if we understand that both good things and calamities come from him? If he's a perfect being and he only does what's perfectly good, why should we complain? What do we have to complain about? Even if a calamity comes. And again, there's nothing wrong. If calamity comes in your life and you cry out to God in pain and ask for relief, that's not complaining. There's nothing wrong with that. Complaining is this kind of bitter attitude towards God that rejects his plan for your life. So, Philippians 2, he says, do everything without complaining and arguing. It's a profound verse. And then he says this, verse 15. Let's just move on to the next part of this long sentence. He says, so that, here's why you need to do it, so that you may become blameless and pure children of God without fault. Blameless means to be above reproach, to live a life so that when people observe you, they can't see any sin, they can't see any obvious flaw. We talked about that with church leadership. Leaders need to be above reproach. And guess what? Non-leaders need to be above reproach. That's why leaders need to be above reproach, so they can be an example, so that no one can find anything against you. And then pure, the word pure is more of an internal emphasis. It means pure. It means undefiled or clean on the inside, innocent. So the two words together describe just being faultless inside and out, all the way around, having a faultless life. Remember that. The goal of the Christian life is always nothing short of blamelessness. That's our goal. That's always the standard. Don't ever think that you've arrived just because you're doing pretty good in comparison with everyone else, because the average isn't the standard. The standard is always blamelessness. That's a good thing to keep in mind. That's our goal. And he says, do this so that you may become what you're supposed to be. That is, blameless and pure. And then he says this, children of God without fault. Now, without fault is real similar to blameless and pure. Those three words are real similar in their construction. Without fault is this word. It's amometa. And it's an interesting word because it comes from the word momus, which was a Greek god. Momus was a complaining deity that never did anything himself. All he ever did was sit around and find fault with everything everyone ever did or ever said. That's momus. And so this word developed, amometa, and what it means is to live a life such that not even Momus himself could find fault with it. Pretty high standard. Not even a complainer could find a problem with it. So, children of God without fault. And we need to become that kind of child. You need to become a child of God. I'm telling you this morning, you all need to become children of God without fault. You say, wait a minute, I'm already a child of God. I'm already born again. I was adopted into God's family when I became a Christian years ago. I'm already in his family. Why do I need to become a child of God? Well, it's just like Jesus said in Matthew 5:45. Remember when he was saying that at the end of Matthew 5, when he says you need to love your enemies. Don't just love your friends, but also love your enemies. Why? So that you may become sons of your Father in heaven. And that's the exact same construction, same exact word, and same kind of a form of it that we have here. And here's the explanation. We're already children by adoption, but we need to become children by resemblance. Sometimes in that culture, when they said a son, especially if they said a son, but also children, what that means is to resemble. Like the sons of the prophets are not, when you see that phrase, that's not talking about the actual descendants of the prophets, that's talking about people that resemble the prophets. That is, they're prophets themselves. And we need to become sons of God in that sense. That is, we are like God, we behave like God, our character is like God. That's what it means to become children of God without fault. Now, let me show you something that's just fascinating. Turn to Deuteronomy 32, and you're going to love this. At least I love it. I don't know if you're going to love it or not, but I thought it was fascinating. Deuteronomy 32, which is what Paul's quoting here. This is just great. I wish NIV doesn't, it changes it around, so you're not going to appreciate it. In NIV, verse 5 of Deuteronomy 32 says, to their shame, they're no longer his children, but a warped and crooked generation. Let me read you that, just how it would sound right out of the Hebrew. It's literally this. It says, they are not his children because of fault, a crooked and depraved generation. They're not his children because of fault, a crooked and depraved generation. It's talking about the ancient Israelites. It's talking about apostate Israel that had turned away from God in idolatry, and finally God becomes so exasperated, he says, you're not my children anymore. He said that to the Israelites. He said, they're not his children because of the fault that's in them. Instead, they're a crooked and depraved generation. Now, in the Philippians 2, now if you look at the Greek translation of that verse that Paul had, the Septuagint, and then you look at the Greek of Philippians 2:15, you'll find that this is exactly the same. Children of God, except in place of the word because of fault, he puts the word without fault. So that you might become children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and depraved generation. Now, you see, what Paul's doing here is fascinating. What he's doing is he's quoting this passage about that was spoken about the Israelites, apostate Israel, but he reverses all the language when he applies it to us, or to the people in Philippi, and to us as well. So he says, they were no longer God's children because of their fault. Instead, they were a crooked and depraved generation, but you are to become children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and depraved generation. Now, here's where it gets interesting. What was their fault? What fault was there that was so severe in Deuteronomy 32 that God said to his own chosen precious people, you are not my children anymore? Two things. First, ingratitude. If you look at Deuteronomy 32, I don't know if you're there, but if you look at Deuteronomy 32, I just read verse 5. If you pick it up from verse 6, he describes what the problem was. Listen to the ingratitude of Israel. He says, "Is he not your father, your creator, who made you and formed you? Remember the days of old." Verse 8, "When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, and he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the people and everything, and for the and to the number of the sons of Israel. For Yahweh's portion is his people. As he gave this nation this, and that nation that, and that nation this, but Israel he gave himself. And Jacob is his allotted inheritance. In a desert land he found them, in a barren and howling waste. He shielded him, and he cared for him, and he guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, that spreads its wing to catch them and carries them in its pinions. Yahweh alone led him." Talking about Israel. "No foreign god was with him. And he made him ride on the heights of the land, and fed him with the fruits of the field, and he nourished him with honey from the rock, and the oil from the flinty crag, and with curds and milk, and so on." He just goes on and on about all these things God did. He drank of the foaming blood of the grape, and so on. Verse 15, "Gershom grew fat and kicked, filled with food. He became heavy and sleek, and he abandoned God, the God who made him, and rejected the rock, his Savior." God did all that. And Israel abandoned God. What ingratitude. And then look at verse 6, beginning of verse 6. He says, "Is this the way you repay Yahweh, O foolish and unwise people? I gave you all this, and this is how you respond?" Ingratitude. And then also, the second thing is idolatry. We're talking about what is their fault that caused them no longer to be God's children. First, it was ingratitude. Secondly, it was that ingratitude was expressed through idolatry. Look at verse 15 of Deuteronomy 32. "He abandoned the God who made him and rejected the rock, his Savior." Verse 16, "They made him jealous with their foreign gods and angered him with their detestable idols." It was idolatry. They were committing idolatry. They were worshiping idols. They were breaking the first command. "No other gods before me." And so they rejected their God, and they were called, as a result, a crooked and depraved generation. So, what's the implication for us? The fact that Paul quotes this passage, what does that mean for us? Well, for one thing, it means we should probably steer clear of ingratitude and idolatry, right? I mean, that's a pretty fair assumption. We should not engage in ingratitude or idolatry because that's the fault, and we're called here to be children without fault. Now, you want to have a test of whether or not you're guilty of ingratitude or idolatry? Just look at what comes out of your heart in a way of complaining, because complaining is a symptom of both idolatry and ingratitude. It's a symptom of that very fault. Complaining is a monumental display of ingratitude. I mean, if you just think about that, I mean, God has given us so much. He's given me, I mean, he's blessed me with so much. And I'm going to complain about what he hasn't given me? Think about what we've been given. I mean, the very types of things that we tend to complain about betray the level of our ingratitude, right? I mean, if you talk to some of the millions of people around the world who at this very moment are starving to death and watching their children starve, literally starve to death in front of them. And then you look at what the kinds of things that cause us to complain. Oh, no! This food I have in front of me, it's great food, it's my favorite food, it's expensive food, and it's a lot of variety, and it's wonderful and everything, but it's the wrong temperature. It's several degrees too cold. I can't eat this slop. Talk to people who have to walk everywhere they go, you know, often on with bare feet and on shoes, often on rugged terrain, and tell those people, hey, did you know that there are some people in this world who they each have their own car, their own personal car, and for a half hour's wages, they can fill up the tank with gas and drive for hundreds of miles anywhere they want to go, zooming along. And those very people, if they're going along and someone comes in front of them so that they have to drive 60 miles an hour instead of 65 for a few minutes, they will literally blow up in anger and cry out to God and say, God, why are you letting me have such a rotten day? I mean, it's really the serious things that get us complaining, isn't it? Go to Calcutta and talk to some of the people that are born on the sidewalk, live on the sidewalk, and die on the sidewalk, and never have a home, and tell them about how you can't possibly stand to live in your house anymore because the cheap carpet stains too easily, or a door squeaks, or the kitchen's too small, or something. I mean, just think about the things that we complain about. God has given us eternal life, and we'll complain about a stuck zipper. I mean, Jesus Christ suffered crucifixion for us, and we moan about the price of gas. While we were yet his enemies, he adopted us into his own family, and we bellyache about having to stand in a long line with a slow checker, or a short line with a slow checker, any line. We've been given the Holy Spirit to live inside us. And we'll grumble because we get a phone call around dinner time. We've been given an inheritance that will never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you. And we gripe because we can't find our car key or something. All the guilt of all the sins of your entire life have been forgiven, completely wiped out at great cost to God. And we complain about somebody who always interrupts us when we're talking. What is it that we think we deserve? God has given us so much. I mean, the Israelites were complaining about actually food and water that they need to live, but look at the things that we tend to complain about and ask yourself, what do I think I deserve? You know, that's a great question to ask yourself. When I was a rafting guy, I had a problem with complaining. I complained all the time, and I had a friend who really would check me on that. And I remember one day, I was complaining because of the low water. You see, if there's not very much snowfall during the winter, then the summer, the rivers are low. And when the river's low, it's not very much fun rafting because instead of rapids, you just have rocks. And it's a lot more work for the guide, and it's tough to make the people have fun when there's no rapids and so on, and so it makes a lot more work. And I was always griping and complaining, oh, the water's low, this place is a dust bowl, you know, we're never going to get down the river, and it's, I wish we'd get some, look at that, the snow's gone, and it's still June. Finally, my friend Dan said, he just interrupted me, he said, do you deserve high water? You put it that way. What do we think we deserve? Well, ask the people who are closest to you, what is it that you complain about? And some of you will find out. Somebody will, you know, they'll say, I'm glad you asked, you know. Because for some of us, it's absolutely a way of life, complaining. But anyway, find out what you complain about. And when you find out, whatever you do, don't try and solve the problem by just keeping your mouth shut from now on. That won't do anything. Because you can be a complainer without ever saying a word, right? If you cultivate thoughts of discontent in your heart, you can do that without ever expressing them. For example, I can probably think of something that you complain about that you never say much about. If you're married, I bet I know what you complain about in your own heart and don't ever say it to anybody. Your spouse. You say, how do you know that? Well, first of all, because I got the same fallen flesh you do. But even without that, if you look in the Bible, who was the very first complainer ever walked this earth? And what was the very first complaint ever expressed in human history? God, this woman that you gave me. And by the way, that very complaint gives us a lot of insight into complaining, because one of the things it teaches is that every complaint, no matter who you direct it against, it's ultimately directed at God, who's ultimately in charge of everything that happens around you. Adam was being held accountable for the sin, and he tried to pass it off, and he wasn't blaming Eve, he was blaming God. He was saying, this woman that you gave me, you did it, God. You could have created, I mean, it's not my fault. I didn't marry. You know, I went to bed, I went to sleep single, I woke up married. You gave her to me, and you could have created any woman you wanted to create and make my wife, and here you give me the one woman that chooses to plunge all of humanity into sin.
It's your fault.
You know, and see, the complaint is, ultimately, complaining is always against God. But we do that. We do that with our spouses. Something you don't like about your spouse, and you complain about it in your heart. You never say anything, but it's inside you. That's complaining just as much as if you express it. And it's complaining against God. He's the one that provided you with your spouse. So, complaining is a symptom of ingratitude. It's a symptom of ingratitude. And you could also say it's a symptom of idolatry. You think about the materialism in our culture, and I'll just quickly mention this, and then we'll be done here. Idolatry is when you turn to someone or something other than God in order to provide for you that which only God provides, that which you're supposed to look to God to provide. And complaining is an evidence of a misdirected pursuit of fulfillment. We are to seek fulfillment from God, not from temporal things. Materialism in our culture is just as much idolatry as an idol worship would be. Because we become devoted to the things that we think will bring us satisfaction, and we make those things a priority, and they become too important to us so that when God stands in our way of getting those things, we become angry at God. And then we know we've crossed over the line into idolatry. Those things are actually more important to us than God, and more lovely to us than God. If you observe our culture, you'll notice that it's an amazing thing. The most indulgent society seems to be the most complaining society, because the more people have, the less content they seem to be. You'd think in a culture with everything that we have, you would never be able to hear a complaint. But we're a very complaining society. We raise our kids to be materialistic by always trying to make them happy through earthly things. And we overindulge them, and the more we overindulge them, the less happy they tend to be. And that's also a function of our wealth and the size of our families. A lot of times you have a small family, average family is just one or two kids, and a lot of times the family can get to the point where it revolves around the child. Child-centered family, and the whole family bends to the child. Child gets up and mom says, "What would you like for breakfast?" "This, nah, this, nah, this, nah, this, nah, okay, I'll do. Okay, I'll make you that. And what would you like in your lunch?" And, and they get a little older, what time will you be home for dinner so that I can plan for you? And you don't like that? I'll take it right off the plate and I'll put this on there. And where would you like to go on vacation? The whole thing bends to the kid. And the kid, grows up thinking that he becomes an adult, thinking that it's everyone's job to make him happy. And, a little bit bigger family, it's not like that. A lot of times, a large family, a lot of times you notice children in large families tend to be a lot more contented because, you got six or eight kids or something, you get up in the morning and go to school and you get handed a bag. There's your lunch. You don't like it, you don't eat lunch. And you come home and dinner's at 5:30, you're here or not, it's at 5:30. And if you're sitting there at dinner and you say, "I don't like this," and the kid next to you says, "Good," and he takes it, So a lot of times that's, that happens. And all I'm saying here is we can actually train you can train your children not to be materialistic even if you only have one child. I'm not saying that, but it's hard because there's a temptation to overindulge that child. I mean, parents of large families have the same temptation. They just don't have that much time or money. So they can't do it. But that's a temptation. And we raise our children to become materialistic. We become materialistic. And we seek satisfaction and fulfillment in not only material things, but worldly things in general. Relationships, people, places, jobs, occupations, things, money, whatever. And we think that those things will make us happy, and we seek after them and chase after them, and they don't make us happy, they don't make us fulfilled, but they do bring a little bit of pleasure. And so we think, if I just get a little bit more, I'll have even more pleasure. And I get more, then finally I'll reach fulfillment and contentment. And you won't. It's elusive. So, complaining is a serious sin for four reasons. It demonstrates a lack of faith. It shows contempt for God. It's a mark of enormous ingratitude. And it's a symptom of idolatry. It's actually idolatrous. Because we're seeking satisfaction in those things that God doesn't provide, which means we think those things are more important than what God provides. So, God is saying here, don't be like apostate, idolatrous Israel, who are no longer my children. Instead, become blameless and pure, faultless, genuine children. And what's the difference? What's the line of demarcation between us and them? It's in 1 Corinthians 10. We're out of time this morning, so I'm not going to get into 1 Corinthians 10, but it's there. And what you'll find is, the line of demarcation is complaining. 1 Corinthians 10:10 says, do not grumble, as some of them did, and were killed by the destroying angels. These things happened to them as examples, and were written down as warnings for us. Don't complain. That's a warning for us. We are called to live a life of obedience, humble obedience, and humble obedience involves your attitude towards God, and that attitude is one that submits to God's providential plan for your life. Whatever God hands you, you say, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. And you can pray for change, you can ask for change, but in the meantime, you submit to whatever God has given you with an attitude of love towards God and acceptance and not hostility.